We have PolitiFact with us to get perspective on last night's Democratic presidential primary debate. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. PolitiFact is a fact-checking site. It rates the accuracy of claims by elected officials and others on its Truth-O-Meter. Maybe you've seen the Pants on Fire rating. And we wanted to run some of the candidate statements and positions that we're hearing in debates through the Truth-O-Meter testing ground, if you will. Did you watch last night's debate? What moments stood out to you? Is there a claim that was challenged by candidates that you want more context on? We're at 800-642-1234. Angie Holin is the editor of PolitiFact. She helped launch PolitiFact in 2007, and it's now part of Poynter Institute, the nonprofit journalism education center. Angie, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So a dozen Democratic presidential candidates on the stage last night in Ohio, fourth debate. Wondering, now that we're in the fourth one here, are you seeing any patterns anywhere? What did you see in last night's debate that we've seen before?
Well, I think what we saw before was a lot of unity among the Democrats on their opposition to Donald Trump and their general policies promoting health care and working against income inequality. But where things got interesting were the details. I think last night they really mixed it up over some of the best ways that they want to approach health care, what they think about the economy. And we kind of saw a division between what I would call the pragmatists or the moderates and the more hard-charging progressives.
Yeah, so there is this friction between progressive and moderates. We heard from South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who criticized progressives throughout the debate for wanting to go too far. Let's hear a bit of that.
Think about what the president can do to unify a new American majority for some of the boldest things we've attempted in my lifetime. Medicare for all who want it. Actually getting something done on immigration for the first time since the 80s. An assault weapons ban, which would be a huge deal. Making college free for low and middle income students. Yet there are some here on this stage who say it doesn't count unless we go even further.
Okay, so lots of examples he's throwing out there. How are candidates really grappling with where the party is going?
Well, I think part of the subtext here is that Elizabeth Warren seems to be claiming a front runner status. She's one of the more progressive candidates. She's got a lot of plans. She wants to have a wealth tax. She supports a single payer healthcare system. And I think the other candidates are seeing her growing popularity and they're saying, whoa, wait a minute. Buttigieg and Warren had a real moment when Buttigieg basically made the point, a point that we fact-checked and found accurate, that most Americans do not want to see private health care insurance abolished, which is what would happen under Warren's plan.
She was really under attack last night from the other candidates. How did she take that, those criticisms? What did you see there?
Well, it was interesting because I don't think she's really been criticized that much during the debates previously.
Okay.
In the previous debate, she was just kind of setting out her agenda. Last night, she did come under attack, like on a style points, as she handled it pretty well. But Warren's also making a philosophical argument here, which is that the Democrats have been too moderate in their positions. They need stronger positions to attack income inequality, deal with corruption in the government, favoritism. She says the government serves the wealthy and corporate interests, and a lot of her plans go right at that point. And she doesn't back down. She does not. She definitely doesn't back down when other candidates challenge her that she's going too far. She sticks to her guns, and she tells people the Democrats need a candidate who is has strong positions on these issues.
We're talking with Angie Holin. She's editor of PolitiFact. We're looking at her notes from last night's presidential primary debate, fourth one of the 2020 election cycle. You can join in. Does watching debates, does it help you decide who you want to vote for? Or do you watch them just to see where the candidates stand on different issues and how well they'll perform? Do you wonder about how a candidate phrases a certain position and how the statements hold up? We're at 800-642-1234. 1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Ed now in West Allis. Hi, Ed.
Well, for those of us in organized labor, and labor issues were discussed for a scant 9.5 minutes last night. Out of the 12 candidates, we only have one-twelfth who we support, and that's Bernie Sanders. No one brought up or broached the PRO Act, the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, that has morphed from the Employee Free Choice Act. And now that's the go-to act that we support in Congress to get organized labor back into power. And we have Mr. Andrew Yang talking about everybody's going to be automated. Well, if everybody's going to be automated, then we don't have much of a society. And we should have stemmed this. Of course, automation only affected the industrial workers. We could automate most of the legal profession.
Ed, let's pause right there and get some reaction from Angie. How did they address labor last night, especially as they're in Ohio?
Yeah, this was interesting. There was a lot of talk about workers and supporting workers. I would say that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are very much on the same team on their policy issues, and they've really been refraining from attacking each other or creating contrasts. And we saw that again last night. They did not fuss with each other. The automation discussion and Andrew Yang, I thought, was fascinating because the moderators asked all pretty much all the candidates. Now, there were 12 on stage, maybe not every single one, but there was an extended discussion of automation and is it hurting jobs? And I think that is a credit to Andrew Yang's candidacy. It was really a clear example of how candidates who are not part of the political mainstream can run for office. They can champion an issue and they can get it on the agenda. I don't think there would have been that discussion without Yang's presence on the stage. It is a tricky issue, though, and this is one of the issues that we could not resolve during our fact checking last night. We are still doing research into this question of automation and jobs because, I mean, you would think like, oh, it's just natural. Automation would kill jobs. People are replaced by robots. But the economists say it's actually not that straightforward because the automation also increases productivity and creates economic activity. So we're hoping to sort that out and have a report on our site later on today.
Well, speaking of Andrew Yang, he called out Senator Warren on her plan for a wealth tax by saying they've tried it out in European countries. How did that work through the Truthometer? What did you find?
Yeah, we found similar claims like this before, mostly accurate. Now, what Yang is saying is you can tax wealth, you can try to tax wealth, but wealthy people are going to find ways to hide that wealth. And he says, we know this because of the experience in Europe, that some European nations tried wealth taxes. They had a hard time collecting it, and so they gave it up. We've rated that mostly true. That does seem to be the experience in Europe, with a big asterisk that just because it didn't work in Europe doesn't mean it wouldn't work here. The government has a lot of power to affect tax collections, and you can imagine them designing a system that would be hard to get around. Elizabeth Warren made the point last night that if you really want to attack inequality in any serious way, you need to tax wealth, not just income, which is a.
We have the editor of PolitiFact with us, Angie Holin, as our guide as we take stock of the fourth Democratic presidential primary debate last night in Ohio. Your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about last night's fourth Democratic presidential primary debate. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The attacks on Senator Elizabeth Warren, they piled on at the debate with 12 contenders on stage outside Columbus, Ohio. We have PolitiFact as our guide morning after with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Did this debate change your opinion on any of the candidates? What did you think of the candidate's criticisms of Senator Warren? Do you agree with them? How well do you think she responded? Join in at 800-642-1234, and Angie Holland stays with us. She is editor of PolitiFact. Angie, the debate started off with a question about the impeachment inquiry, and the moderator asked why President Trump's fate should be decided by Congress and not by voters. How did the candidates respond to that?
Well, they basically piled on to Donald Trump. A couple of them said he was the most corrupt president in history. We're thinking about seeing if we can look at that in any sort of objective way. I think their main point was that they just feel that his behavior in office has been so poor that that Congress is duty bound to pursue the impeachment process. Now, none of them really got into what will happen if the House votes for impeachment, if it goes to a Senate trial, and then he is not convicted, which it seems likely he would not be because he has enough senators in his own party to support him and stop his removal.
But still, there were a lot of ears last night on how former Vice President Joe Biden would respond. And we're hearing here two pieces of his response.
My son did nothing wrong. I did nothing wrong. I carried out the policy of the United States government. What we have to do now is focus on Donald Trump. He doesn't want me to be the candidate. He's going after me because he knows if I get the nomination, I will beat him like a drum.
Okay, so what is your take on how Biden responded there?
Biden has the facts on his side that he himself did nothing wrong. That is certainly what we found in our reporting and researching on the issue. Biden's efforts to get a prosecutor fired seem entirely based in the administration's policy position and, frankly, the position of the broader EU community. I think there's more of a question about politicians' relations taking jobs that are based on their name. And he was asked a couple of times about Hunter Biden, his son, should he have even taken the job in the first place? And he basically said, you know, my son speaks for himself. He said that a couple of times. And Hunter Biden yesterday gave an interview where he talked about that he didn't do anything wrong. And I would say our fact-checking efforts, we haven't seen allegations of wrongdoing against Hunter Biden himself, but it didn't look good. So
we haven't mentioned yet Senator Bernie Sanders, who is recovering from a heart attack. So the moderators asked him about his health. And let's hear some of that exchange. Oh, I'm sorry. We don't have the Bernie Sanders clip, but did the candidates talk a little bit about their age? And as the front runners at this point who are older, they're all in their 70s. And how did they respond to that?
Yeah, they did say that they were going to release their medical records. In Biden's case, he said he would release his medical records before Iowa. I mean, Sanders' health was addressed, but I have to say I was a little surprised that it wasn't addressed more seriously. It seems like I think Sanders should have been pressed a little more on that. He did have a heart attack, but you know, I think that there's some reticence in the media to press candidates too much about personal health issues. I'm not sure how if this is going to be discussed anymore. But Sanders did look fine last night. He looked. It was one of his better debates. He smiled. He made some jokes. He didn't shout, which he's done sometimes. So Sanders looked healthy and vigorous on the stage. Elizabeth Warren also addressed her age. I forget if she's 70 or 71, but she talked about how she felt ready and she could, had the energy to take on Trump. So that was the health discussion.
We're talking with Angie Holland, the editor of PolitiFact. We're getting morning after analysis on the fourth presidential primary debate held last night in Ohio. Still time for your questions and reaction, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Kelly now in Milwaukee. Hi, Kelly.
Oh, good morning. I had a question about the lack of press for Tulsi Gabbard. I'm a big fan of her. She's so intelligent. And you know, it's just sad because she talked about regime change and our role in regime change, and it hasn't been addressed. And I just have to say, some heart attacks aren't what they used to be. They put a little stent in, and you're ready. You're actually ready to be out of the hospital within 24 hours. So I just wanted to add that.
Kelly, thanks for that context. And, you know, Kelly, talking about Representative Tulsi Gabbard there, she said that the media called her a Russian asset. What was she talking about? And is that true?
Yeah, this was mixed. She said the New York Times and CNN called her a Russian asset. Now, the New York Times did not call her a Russian asset. They looked at what the New York Times did was they looked at some of her positions that are anti-war, and they looked at some of the support she's getting from the alt-right. Now, I'm really giving this a broad brush, so I would encourage people to go and read the story for themselves. We link it from our site. But she's right that a CNN commentator called her a Russian asset. This was a pundit on CNN that said it. Gabbard is a really interesting candidate because she has some very eclectic positions. And last night, she really made a strong case that the U.S. Policy in Syria has been wrong since the Obama administration. And obviously, that's a really complicated situation. We are, again, working on some more background on this topic to put her claims in context and give people a little bit more history about the conflict in Syria.
Kelly, thanks. Let's bring in Steve now in Sun Prairie with thoughts on last night. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I voted for Obama in 08, and Obama in 08 would be considered too right-wing for where the party is right now. The only normal person in there who is Joe Biden, and Joe Biden is correct. He would beat Trump like a drum. But the party itself has moved so far to the left, let's call it what it is. It's an extremist party. That's what we would have used as a language of Republicans. They're a party of extremes. The only one that can win is Joe Biden.
Steve, thanks for those thoughts. You know, what do you make of the party moving in what Steve thinks is an extremist territory?
Well, I would say we've covered primary races over several cycles, and we're seeing a really common dynamic here, which is the candidates all trot to one side during the primary. The Democrats go to the left in the Republican primaries. We've seen all the candidates go to the right, and then they try to come back for the general election. I would say that your caller is quite right that Biden is one of the more middle candidates. Depending on how you want to call it, he's not as far to the left as some of the other candidates. I would also put Pete Buttigieg in that camp and Amy Klobuchar, who also had some nice moments last night. But it's interesting because it's like as the country has gone more partisan, the Republicans have certainly gone farther to the right and the Democrats have gone farther to the left. And we're seeing that in this race.
Julian Castro on the stage last night saying that Ohio, Michigan and Pennsylvania have actually lost jobs since President Trump's election. What did your investigations find on that?
We rated this false. Now, when we looked at the overall numbers, we looked at the most recent month, we looked at year over year. Jobs are growing in these states and generally around the country. And I think that's just a fact that Trump is governing during a time of positive economic activity. When we asked him about it, he said, well, if you looked at March until now, there would be losses. So he's just taking a little tiny window. But overall, this claim just did not make it doesn't match with reality. These states are seeing job growth.
Okay, Angie, so do you think that this debate gives us any clues as to what the future debates will look like and how the candidates will behave on their positions as they move forward in their campaigns?
There were 12 candidates on stage, and I think the next debate, the way they've set the rules, they're going to be fewer. I'm not sure that voters can process 12 candidates, so I'm interested to see as the field gets a little smaller. I think we'll see at least 8 candidates in next month's debate. I think we're going to continue to see Democrats discuss this really big debate between hard charging policies and electability.
Well, Angie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Angie Holin is the editor of PolitiFact. Coming up next, the Wisconsin Secretary of Revenue, Peter Barca, joins us to talk about the work of his agency around tax policy. What questions do you have about how the Revenue Department works? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back after a news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and right now we're talking with Revenue Secretary Peter Barca. Last week, the state Senate unanimously voted to approve five of Governor Evers' cabinet picks, including Peter Barca as the Department of Revenue Secretary. In recent months, we here at The Morning Show, we've been having conversations with state agency heads. What do you want to know about how the work of the state revenue department, how it functions on state policy, on tax policy? Has your business worked with the revenue department on a compliance issue? What was it like to work with the revenue department? What was the outcome? We're at 800-642-1234. Revenue Secretary Peter Barca previously represented Assembly District 64 as a Democratic state representative from Kenosha. Secretary Barca, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, Kate, great to be here with you.
It's been a
studio
while.
On NOLA.
I know,
so this
studio
is wonderful.
No less. Well, the Revenue Department has its hands in many facets of government. Money flows through every function of the system. You've wanted to take a customer service approach, you said, to running the Revenue Department. What does that mean?
Well, it means a couple of different things. In fact, when I first talked with Governor Evers about this position, I had mentioned how in President Bill Clinton's administration, I had been named in charge of the National Regulatory Fairness Commission, which came about as a result of the SBREFA legislation, Small Business Regulatory Enforcement and Fairness Act. And the whole idea there was to make it easier for companies to comply with the law, to work with them on a cooperative basis and to help them to understand what their obligations were and to find ways to make it as easy as possible, to cut red tape, things of that sort. And in fact, we just, in the past couple of weeks, Governor Evers and ourselves, we had launched a new Badger initiative. Of course, after that victory over Michigan State, what would be better, right? But that stands for Business Development and Government Relations. And we work very closely with small business organizations across the state, whether it be like the NFIB or the Independent Business or the Women's Business Initiative and many others, Waukesha Business Alliance. We had focus groups and talked to them about what would be important. And Governor Evers, being very customer-friendly himself, believing that we really need to reach out to the people of the state and offer our assistance, we talked with them, and they thought that creating like a landing page for them to be able to access information easier, sharing data. We now open up once again to create these quarterly economic outlooks where we can provide information on where the economy is going, what's going on with housing starts, what's going on with exports, what is the overall outlook for GDP growth.
So really leveraging your internal economics experts as well. And so as you've been cutting some of this red tape and really helping focus on what businesses need here, you're also working to root out payroll fraud. In July, 50 companies were suspected of payroll fraud in their businesses. Can you tell us about the work being done here?
Yes, absolutely. Well, Governor Evers created a commission that was launched quite a while ago. He announced it, and they had their first meeting. I think they've had a couple meetings now. In fact, Governor Evers was at the first meeting, where it's a cooperative effort with DWD. In fact, Secretary Frostman is chairing the initiative. Maria Guerra-Lapasic, who is one of our deputy secretaries, is helping to lead the effort for us. And the whole idea is to make sure that we don't put companies in Wisconsin who follow the rules, who do everything right, are put at a competitive disadvantage to some, in many cases, out-of-state companies who are really scammers, who are mistreating their workers, calling them independent contractors, or even worse, perhaps paying them with gift cards as opposed to paying them with regular paychecks. So as a result, workers' comp isn't being taken out, unemployment comp isn't being taken out. So that means Wisconsin businesses who are doing everything right are having to compete for contracts, against companies that are just totally abusing the system.
Not following the letter of the law.
And then when their workers get hurt, workers' comp then in our healthcare system still, of course, will provide care, through emergency rooms and things of that sort, but it's an expensive, inefficient way to do that. So we really, our goal is to shut down companies like that. There's no room for them in Wisconsin. We want to deal with companies that are above board, that understand the way the Wisconsin system works, and that we've got legitimate companies. And this is one that you might find interesting, Kate. Yeah. This is one where union and non-union businesses are locked together, because it's one of those rare occasions where they all follow the rules and they don't want scammers to be part of it.
Well, there are more than 400,000 small businesses in Wisconsin. How big of an issue is payroll fraud compared to the other issues you're clamping down on?
Well, it's actually a pretty big issue because for all the reasons that I mentioned, and unfortunately, I think that because the environment's changed over the last decade in Wisconsin with right to work and eliminating prevailing wage, I think sometimes it attracts companies like this to come to Wisconsin thinking somehow that it's the Wild West and they can get away with doing anything. And in fact, that's not the case. And we have, investigations underway with over 100 companies. And I know DWD similarly has people out in the field doing investigations as well. And we're finding these companies, and we just want to put people on notice that there's no room for people that scam the system in the state, because we're a state that's always prided itself on working with legitimate businesses who care about their workers, who pay their fair share, and they should not be at a competitive disadvantage by these scamming-type operations.
Drew, if you're just joining us, we're talking with Peter Barca. He is Wisconsin's Revenue Secretary, and we're looking at the inner workings of the Department of Revenue. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. If you're a small business, what do you need out of the Revenue Department? What types of support or economic forecasts, perhaps, that you would be helpful in running your business? Join in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. So Governor Evers signed this executive order last spring to create this task force on misclassification and payroll fraud. The task force met twice so far. What is the task force working on?
Well, they're working on a whole wide array of issues. First of all, looking at how we can better identify companies, how we can have effective investigations, how we can work together across agencies, whether it be Department of Workforce Development and DOR or other agencies as well that come across these types of companies, how we can share data, and how we can be more effective in making sure that we communicate aggressively that this is not a state where they're welcome.
When you say misclassification, what is that exactly? How does that work for a business?
Well, it can mean something such as where you call an employee an independent contractor. Where they really are an employee. I mean, to be an independent contractor, generally speaking, that means that you have a variety of clients, that you're not just serving one person. When you work for one company, that's a worker. And as a consequence, that company should be paying and withholding money for workers' compensation, unemployment compensation, things of that sort. So, but in many cases, they call them independent contractors, and as a consequence, no money is being put into those funds. And many times there's not withholding for payroll taxes. And in some cases, in the worst kind of conditions, they'll pay them with gift cards even.
Mm. The Department of Workforce Development had a similar task force years ago, but it ended after a year. What did that data show that's from a decade ago?
Well, even back during that period, they did find issues of this sort. We believe that it's gotten far worse over the course of the past decade. And I think that today we have better databases. We can link information across agencies better. It's easier to be able to find identify these companies and find out those that have nexus in the state, those that have come in for a short period of time. Many cases, it can be contractors that come in and underbid legitimate Wisconsin companies, get a short-term contract, and leave without, you know, ever having made any obligations in this state. So I think that we're in a better position today than they were a decade or so ago. And but, you know, we certainly the governors ensure that we've looked at those results, that we've benefited from the work that they've done in the past. But now we're looking to take it to the next level.
And some businesses may misclassify workers due to misunderstanding of the rules. There is a lot of compliance issues you have to really read closely. How does the Revenue Department address those cases?
Mm-hmm. Well, we, you know, in fact, last week, I'm glad you asked this question, Kate, because this past week was Customer Service Week. And we have what I would say is one of the best customer service efforts in all of government. And I would even compare favorably with the private sector. We had a gentleman who worked for us who was visually disabled, who when he worked there, he said, you know, I noticed not everybody seems quite as customer friendly. Why don't we tape record these calls? We started tape recording them. Then a couple years later, he said, you know, why don't we actually ask people for surveys? Ask them if they were satisfied, if the person talking to them was knowledgeable. So do you know that when we have a high percentage of companies and individuals that'll take these surveys, and we get a rating of 98.9% satisfaction? As I was telling our staff the other day, I had to make a hotel reservation with a chain I won't announce publicly in the last few days. And three times they hung up on me, and the fourth time I was finally able to make my reservation. So I think we compare very favorably, and we're very proud of that. And so somebody can call the Department of Revenue. We certainly will help guide them through that data. We'll send them the information if, in fact, there is legitimate confusion, which there can be. There's no question about it. However, I think in most cases, you know, what we found in terms of this task force and the work that we're doing is it's in many cases out-of-state companies that are coming in here to try and, you know, get a quick bid. And that, those are the kinds of things. So there's
getting
no
a
confusion
quick bid
at
on
all.
A job.
They're just scammers. Okay. But if there is legitimate confusion among small businesses, we're very, you know, customer friendly in terms of helping them, sending them information, talking with them over the phone, helping to guide them to answer whatever questions they might have, which is very important because, you know, it's very difficult to run a small business.
You have a line to Revenue Secretary Peter Barca. We're looking at issues the State Revenue Department is working on and his efforts to shape the department. What questions do you have about what the Revenue Department is in charge of? Are you a small business? What issues do you want the agency to address in tax law, in compliance? What challenges do you face? We're at 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Peter Barca here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, you have a line to the State Revenue Secretary, Peter Barca, here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Barca heads the agency that has a hand in many facets of state government, like administering tax laws, estimating state revenues, economic forecasts, running the state lottery, and the unclaimed property program. It is a laundry list. What do you want to know about how the Revenue Department collects taxes and where that money goes after that? Have you called up the department with a question about business taxes or your property tax assessment? What do you want to know? We're at 800-642-1234. Revenue Secretary Peter Barca stays with us. Peter, we can't talk about business development and taxation without talking about Foxconn. Your department oversees the tax credits distributed to Foxconn. And last year, Foxconn missed qualifying for state incentives, not meeting the 260 workers requirement. How is it doing this year in meeting the benchmarks to get tax credits?
Well, it's our understanding that this year it's their intent, and they believe they will, in fact, reach their targets to be able to qualify for tax credits. So we'll find out. Obviously, we're in a little bit of a transition with Secretary Hogan stepping down and Secretary Missy Hughes beginning. And So we generally have regular weekly conference calls with Foxconn to talk over how things are going. I know Governor Evers has made a point to make sure he's met with all the key personnel at Foxconn so that we could discuss what their plans were and what direction we could expect them to be going in. So,
are those weekly conference calls still going on?
No, well, they've been suspended, actually, for the last month or so during this transition-type period, although we've had some interim calls with our own personnel just to make sure that we understood where things were at. So, but I know Secretary Missy Hughes is now fully on the job, and I'll be talking with her a little bit further tomorrow, and I know she's intending on taking this up immediately. And
do you feel like you have a good handle on what Foxconn intends to do in our state?
Well, I think as much as they are able to share with us, you know, in a dynamic business like the technology world, I think that they're still sorting through exactly the kinds of research, what kinds of opportunities might come along. We know for the first phase, obviously, they're in the middle of constructing that first major, well, actually, it's their second building on the Mount Pleasant site, but it's their extremely large building where they'll be building many of the kinds of flat screen monitors, and they're examining now other products that they might manufacture on site as well. But I know that they have had a pretty broad reach. They've met with companies throughout Wisconsin. There's a pretty wide list of vendors. They've done very well in terms of the vendor list of working with minority contractors, women-owned businesses, and so we're pleased to see that. And when they first came here, they had said that they would use that of all the vendor contracts, 25% of them would go to Wisconsin companies. So we're hoping they're going to meet those benchmarks as well.
But if the scale of manufacturing is much smaller, what does that mean for revenue generation in our state and for all the businesses and infrastructure that was planned around this one investment?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's yet to be determined because, you know, obviously they're scaling up. So this first step was a little bit smaller than what we had hoped for and anticipated. But they've certainly assured us on an ongoing basis that they still intend over the course of time to have the exact same number of employees and the exact same scale in terms of the magnitude of their economic impact. So we certainly are talking with them on an ongoing basis, trying to ensure that that happens.
Paul from Nina called in to ask how the Department of Revenue monitors and collects sales taxes from businesses. How does that work?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have an ongoing relationship with businesses, and businesses in Wisconsin do a phenomenal job at collecting sales taxes, and we have the ability to monitor closely their collections, and they pay us on a quarterly basis, and generally speaking, the compliance has been fantastic. This is one arena where I think we've had just a terrific partnership with businesses in terms of the sales tax collection arena.
Talking with Revenue Secretary Peter Barca, speaking of taxes, the Revenue Department started collecting an excise tax on vaping products at the beginning of this month, and you're capturing this untaxed vaping products moving into the state and vaping products made and sold here. So this tax comes at a major public health concerns around vaping. Where will the revenue that's generated go?
Well, the revenue is not designated for any particular purpose at this juncture, although there have been discussions about that, whether or not, given the health hazards that exist, as we look at future initiatives on vaping, if that is something that should be considered because of the public health concerns that have been raised. And I know our Department of Health has been very aggressive in putting out public announcements and making sure people are aware of the dangers. And so we're looking to work in a very cooperative manner with them. And we expect that there will be legislation over the course of the next year. I know Governor Evers is very concerned about this. I talked personally with him about it. And so we're analyzing it closely, and I know legislators are as well. We met with Senator Mark Lyne last week, and they're looking at other potential legislative initiatives, as are legislators in both parties. So it's something I think that should be a nonpartisan issue, should be a bipartisan issue, and I believe it will be.
Do you know how much revenue could be generated from the new tax, and did you model this new tax from anywhere?
Well, we do have an estimate of how much money will come in. It's a fairly modest amount compared to what we get from other excise taxes. It's an initial, I think in the legislature in their final analysis, they decided to go with a pretty modest effort, really, considering the potential health hazard that we have. So that's why I think we're very interested in working in partnership with the legislature to look at other initiatives, because it would be wonderful if you could have dedicated funds to go for, health type hazards and other purposes. But those discussions are ongoing.
Let's go to Nancy now in Milwaukee. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning. I live in Milwaukee, and I've been trying to find out why the Fiserv Arena in downtown Milwaukee, which was built for the Bucks to play in, why this company is not paying any Milwaukee property taxes. I'm wondering if you're now a contract was written, obviously, to provide this concession to these men from Boston who came and somehow inveigled Milwaukee into putting a very large amount of money into the building of this building.
Nancy,
and I am damn mad that I'm paying property taxes and they're not.
Nancy, thanks for the question. Is the Fiserv Forum getting tax credits here?
Well, so I think that to some degree, sometimes there's a misnomer thinking that the Bucks own the Fiserv Arena, and it's a public authority. In fact, I had the great pleasure as the minority leader in the legislature of serving on the Convention Center Board. And when it was negotiated, it was decided that they would keep it within that authority of the Milwaukee Convention Center. Now, they do pay plenty of other taxes. And in fact, the one positive that I think Nancy would be pleased to know is that there'll be a 3-to-1 payoff return on investment. So for every dollar that state taxpayers are investing in the Fiserv Arena, just with the taxes that the players pay, because when LeBron James comes to Milwaukee, the revenue department collects for that day because he obviously pays an enormous amount of taxes, but as do the Milwaukee players. So it's paid based on when they're playing here in the state, and it's a 3-to-1 return on investment. So overall, there is a significant amount of taxes being paid, and it's paying back the investment threefold, which just on the salaries alone, that's not including all the other things that go along with people buying, services or buying hotel rooms or food and other things
all
in the Milwaukee
other
area.
Amenities.
That's over and above that.
We only have a few seconds left, though, but I want to touch lottery program for just a moment. Your department manages the state lottery program, and for many states, lotteries are a valuable source of revenue. Where does Wisconsin's lottery revenue go?
Well, it goes back for property tax relief, and that's why it's such a great fit with the revenue department. And it's produced billions of dollars in property tax relief since its inception 25 years ago. The other kind of humorous anecdote, Kate, people sometimes are surprised to know, Wisconsin's sort of an average-sized state. We're kind of in the middle in terms of population, in terms of size. And we're really almost average in terms of how much we play. But we are sixth luckiest in the entire country for winning. So Wisconsin's a lucky state.
Peter, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. Great to be with you.
Revenue Secretary Peter Barca here on the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show.